Fish number 11885. This is J.H. Mills, reel 2.
Mrs. Mills, reel 2. So, at Duxford, whilst you were there, was there an actual bombing attack by the Germans?
Well, I don't actually remember anything falling on Duxford, not while I was there. But there were dogfights and you know, bombs around us. No, I don't think we weren't damaged. But after a while, I think the Air Ministry policy was that as there was very little protection in these operations rooms on the camps, I mean, it was just a brick building with sort of a bit of protection on the windows and bunkers around the side. So they moved us out to Sawston Hall, which is a stately home about 3 miles away, and they took over the hall, the main hall of this mansion, and converted it into an operations room. And the WAF slept in the quarters above, so that we were moved off to camp.
How long after you've been there did that take place?
I think we moved just after Christmas. But up to then, of course, we lived in these little houses, which in itself was quite an adventure. I often wonder how people would cope with it today, you know, and used to central heating and all life's luxuries. And I mean, these were sort of two up and one down houses with bathroom and kitchen, no visible means of heat. We were about 7 to a house, and I shared a room with another girl. We were just 2 to a room downstairs, but to get any hot water we had to light one of these huge old-fashioned coppers in the kitchen, which was coal-fired, and we had a small coal ration which was dumped outside, and like as not, was, you know, got wet every time it rained. And anyway, we had to kindle a fire in this and then carry the water upstairs, bucket by bucket, to the bathroom if we wanted a bath. I mean, I don't know really how we kept clean and did our washing, but we managed it. And because we had iron beds and a sort of hanging locker, we had an orange box each by the side of the bed, in which we kept our sort of books and makeup, such as it was, and you know, toiletries, chocolate ration. At least we did keep our chocolate rations until the mice got at them. They even ate our soap when they got a bit hungry. And it was very cold, of course, but we did have a fireplace in our room, and we took to going around the woods nearby on our time off and getting wood, you know. And they say when we were off duty, especially in the evening, we would stoke up the fire and draw the black out, you know, and have, I think we had mugs of that sort of, was it camp coffee, that chicory stuff? Yes, I think it was, in bottles. Or ginger wine was another favourite. My mother used to make sort of ginger wine. It had to be diluted with hot water, and then we'd have sort of scrounge bread and make toast and stuff like that, and had the wind-up gramophone going. So we entertained like that. It was quite enjoyable. We were quite cosy, really. But it was the water situation, the hot water situation, that I really remember we had difficulty with. And the thing was getting the wretched boiler alight, because as I said, we didn't have many newspapers, and if we got hold of a newspaper, you know, we all had to read it, and then it was necessary to put it down on our polished floor before inspection, so the muddy footmarks wouldn't go on the floor. And then after, you know, several things like that, we were finally allowed to use it to kindle this wretched boiler thing. And then they said that they weren't safe and they were out of action, we weren't to use them anymore. And I think they had a few bath huts scattered about, but You know, I can imagine we didn't use those too often. We mostly settle for a sort of bowl in front of the fireplace with the blackouts drawn, I think. But, you know, we were young and it, life was, as I said, it was just a big adventure and it was all new to us, so we coped.
Sounds as though you were happy then.
I was, and I was very, very happy. We were a very close community, really, by virtue of the fact that we worked watches, and which, I mean, the MT people did and the telephone operators did, but by and large, most people didn't. And so we were, you know, really friendly with our own watch and our own, they used to do things together, you know, if we could get the time off, we used to hitchhike into Cambridge and go to a tea dance or something like that. At that time, there was a mix of men as well as women. And there was transport into Cambridge, but it only went in the evening, of course, and as we were liable to be off mornings or afternoons, and, you know, it wasn't really, it's very rare that we could take advantage of the bus that was laid on.
Did you feel safe hitchhiking?
Yes, they didn't think anything about it in those days. So, you see, really, the only, if you didn't hitchhike, you didn't go anywhere, and you know, full stop. I mean, if I went home, I'd hitchhike with several. You'd try to do it with somebody. But I remember my father dropping me off at Apex Corner on the way home, you know, and I'd stand there and you'd get something up. You used to get some weird lifts. I remember, you know, once I was in an aircraft carrier, you know, in a big articulated lorry, and we had lifts in police cars. But that's where it was quite handy. There were quite a lot of things going through to Cambridge. It wasn't too difficult. You might have to do it in two or three stages, but Cambridge was our sort of mecca, you know, civilization. And also, because it was a university town, there were lots of cafes and things there, and bookshops and record shops. And then if it was a wet day, it was always good for a browse in the bookshop and then go across to the record shop. And in those days, they had little booths down one length of the shop, and you could say, oh, I'd like to hear so-and-so, and then you could retreat to the booth and play it in peace. So, of course, that would pass away many a wet afternoon, probably ending up with sort of poached egg on toast at one of these little cafes there, and then we'd set off back to camp again.
Did you fraternise with the undergraduates, or were they not?
Not really, no. No. So we kept ourselves quite to ourselves. For one thing, as I said, we weren't allowed to talk about our work at all, and we had to be very cagey. And in fact, when we moved to Sawston Hall, which was a little village, we were specifically told if we had a lift, we were not to be put down within a couple of hundred yards of this place, because they didn't want people to realise. I mean, I'm sure the villagers knew, but the idea was that a lot of Germans had been educated at the British universities, you know, Oxford and Cambridge, during the war. And they thought that if there were going to be paratroopers dropped, and that was the big scare, you know, that spies were going to be dropped by a parachute, they would drop them near familiar places so they would know their way around. So it's all this security business was very intense.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you felt safe hitchhiking? That wouldn't be the case nowadays.
No, wouldn't think of it. Yes, we all did it, and I don't remember hearing anyone have any problems at all. You know, the lorries, mind you, the people who were on the road were largely, there were lots of service lorry, you know, service army trucks and things like that, and or else they were established drivers for large companies or bona fide sort of, you know, there wasn't petrol enough for people to go sort of joyriding, see what they could pick up. It was just difficult. But I mean, trains, we did try occasionally going by train. When we had leave, we had railway warrant, so we'd go by train. But I mean, that was really more hazardous, because you could be stopped. I remember being stopped on the way to Liverpool Street in this train, went off, I suppose, in the early evening, and there were raids and the train just stopped, and we didn't get into Liverpool Street till, must have been about midnight, I suppose, by which time the local tube trains out to Harrow weren't running anymore. And I sort of rang home and asked if anyone could get me, and my father said he just hadn't got any petrol, he couldn't possibly, and he said, no, go to a hotel or something. Well, there were raids going on then still, and I didn't fancy training off in the area of Liverpool Street to find a hotel. So in the end, I went to the rail RTO, Railway Traffic Officer, sort of office there. They were there solely to advise service people, you know, with who were stuck with various problems. And this was manned by some guard regiment, I think, at the time. And I said, well, have you got any ideas how I can get home? And they said, no, you can't. You know, just find somewhere to stay. And I said, well, can't I stay here? Because it looked quite a snug kind of office, and, you know, it's warm and everything. And so they said, oh, no, we're not allowed to stay here. So I said, well, I'm jolly well not going out searching town in the middle of an air raid to find some grotty hotel, or worse to that effect. So in the end, they let me stay there, and they were very sweet, because they closed up also at about midnight. And so they gave me a blanket, and I curled up on the end of the counter and slept there for the night. I remember when I got home the next morning, like the first tube, my father was absolutely horrified and livid, you know, at his daughter to spend the night on a counter manned by guardsmen, you know. Good gracious, my reputation never be the same again. He was really annoyed. I couldn't understand it at the time. It was all so innocent, and I thought it was sensible.
In Duxford, how closely were the young lefts supervised by their superiors?
Oh, we all had to check out and check in again. I can't remember. I think we had to be in by about 10:30 or 11, but we had house inspections, you know, at frequent intervals. We had to keep our houses clean and polished, and we had there was a parade, colour parade, every morning, which we were excused because probably we'd be on duty or we'd be sleeping or something. But we weren't. We did have to go, you know, as and when possible. And of course, we always had uniform. You know, we had to keep our buttons shined up and our shoes cleaned, and we were very. They didn't miss a trick, and they would come and check us in at night. They would come all around the houses with torches and that kind of thing. So, you know, they really knew if you weren't in, you had always had to sign in and give your pass back and things like that.
Did they try to dictate to you whom you could and could not associate with?
Oh, and it was accepted you weren't allowed to associate with officers or anyone in the other ranks, even sergeants and officers. I mean, later on, when I was commissioned, and I used to go around with a sergeant, and it was most difficult. You know, we had both had to cycle that couple of miles from camp before we met up, and that kind of thing. But that was much later. No, we, you know, it was just you weren't expected to, except of course if you were invited to dances. Like we went to a sergeant's mess dance, and some of the officers were there. For instance, Bardo was there. He was CO of 242 at the time. That was one of the Hurricane squadrons, and he always used to back his men up. He's very, very popular with them. You know, he would. He was all for the men of his squadron. He would back them up to the hilt, and so he used to go to their dances, and we came across the officers there. And incidentally, Barter had a very good party trick. He and in those days, there was a dance called the Panic Glide, which consisted of everybody linking arms and trotting around the room. And at the end, you had to swing one leg up and then the other leg up as high as you could go. And of course, he could do that absolutely much better than anybody else, because his artificial legs joined at the hip. You know, he could get them right up to the ceiling, and because everybody stand around, clap and cheer, and he used to quite enjoy it. Another thing about him, he always wore one of his wife's. I don't suppose there were nylons in those days, but stockings round his neck when he flew.
Out of superstition?
I think so. I don't know quite. He just did. But he's very popular. My friend and I used to go around with a couple of the sergeants from his squadron, and they thought the world of him. It's quite interesting. There's 19 squadron there, which was largely sort of British and, you know, university air squadron people, ex-university air squadron. And then there was 242, which was largely Canadians, which was Barders, and 310, which was the Czech squadron. Although there were some English people flying with them. And although we didn't meet them socially a great deal, we knew of them all by repute, you know, and we knew their voices because we could hear them over the radio when they were flying, and that sometimes they would come into the operations room and have a chat, and you know, with the controller and see how things are going.
Can we come back to the work that you were doing there now? Mm-hmm. And can you tell me any specific memories that you have of doing the work in the Battle of Britain?
Yes, I can. Well, apart from my two main memories, as I said, were the first time I plotted anything over where I thought my family were, and that gave me sort of slight anxiety feelings. And the other was when we saw the London burning. But it was always very exciting when there were things happening, you know, because you could see the squadrons go up. And after a little while, Barder led what was known as the Duxford Wing, which comprised another two squadrons. I think it was 302 and 611 that were sort of out on one of the small satellite stations. And they all used to fly down. And so it got very exciting because you could hear the orders being given to them, and from the little rooms, little wireless and radio rooms at the behind the controller, we could hear the crackly voices of the pilots come back. You know, and we could, although we had headsets on, and the work was quite intensive, required a lot of concentration. We used to manage to ease one earphone off so we could hear what was going on, and then we could hear, you know, we listened out for sort of tally-ho, which meant they'd sighted the enemy, and then you could hear them talking to each other like, look out, blue two, bandits to your right, and things like that, which seemed to bring it right into the room. And also there was an indescribable tension about the whole thing, you know, when there was something going on. There was the atmosphere was electric, really, and we were all rooting for our boys to come back. They were very much our pigeon, you know. It's a sort of combined effort as far as we were concerned, although of course they had to be on their own at the time of combat.
Did you get the impression that they were suffering many casualties?
No. I don't think we did lose a great many, actually. Would you mean as a whole, the Air Force as a whole?
Or in just Duxford.
Our little in Duxford? No, we knew it happened, but it was very much the atmosphere, I think, on these stations that one didn't dwell on it. Nobody did. I mean, it hit us at the time, and they'd say, did you know that so-and-so didn't come back today? And you'd be sad about it for a minute, but then life had to go on, and it was the same with the men. You know, they probably go back to the mess or the pub and have some drinks and put it out of their mind. You know, you couldn't. It was a kind of, I suppose, natural reaction. You couldn't allow yourself to dwell on things, or else you wouldn't have survived. I mean, there were one or two girls who did prove to be some extra sensitive, and they had to get out of it because, you know, you really couldn't cope. Not that the rest of us were tough, if you follow me, but it was just one of those things, you know, it was the way of life, and there was so much going on all the time, and you were so busy, probably that helped.
What happened to these girls who were pulled out?
I suppose they did some other job.
They show their morale wasn't suitable?
Well, I think some of them, I only knew one actually, but I know it did happen. It happened at more at fighter command, where it was even more intensive. But they just got to, they got weepy and couldn't cope with it, you know, general sort of nervous strain and everything. And I suppose that they must have gone to one of the WAF officers or somebody must have noticed, you know, and they usually, they voluntarily sort of asked to be transferred to something else. They didn't happen very often. You know, most of us were just sort of so proud to be doing it, I think. You know, we felt a bit special, I suppose.
But do you think that they couldn't stand it because of the pressure of the work, or because of the thought of all the pilots being killed and maimed?
Probably both, I should think. Probably both. You know, some people seem to cope with emergencies better than others. You know, some people, well, I think I'm one that if there's any emergency, I want to be busy and do things, you know, and get on with it. And some people, it takes completely the opposite way, and they just, you know, it's all too much and they can't cope. But it didn't happen very often. So I can only think of one girl, but then probably, you know, we might not have been told the reasons for them. People would transfer and go on administration courses to become administration corporals or something like that. And most of us liked the work too much, and we just enjoyed it.
You talked about hearing pilots speaking to each other.
Mm.
They weren't supposed to do that, really, I think.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in combat, when they were no longer being given directions, I didn't know that they weren't. So it happened all the time, and you know, interspersed with pretty choice language as well. Which, you know, I think they were. There's another thing they thought that perhaps the WAF wouldn't take to, but because it wasn't as common in those days to hear a lot of the bad language as it seems to be today. But we did definitely hear them. I mean, it stands to reason if you're working in three aircraft to a flight, you're in your own flight, the three of the team is the same as the three comprise the larger team of the squadron. And if you see somebody approaching your mate from some sort of slightly obscured angle, it's natural to just sort of shout out, I should think. I never knew they weren't supposed to do it. They certainly did do it.
Did you ever hear anything harrowing when the pilots were actually hit?
No. Well, no, except that you'd hear, oh, so-and-so's bought it or something like that, but then it would, you know, go off.
Who was in charge of the work in the... Who was in charge of your work in the actual operations room?
Well, overall, it would be the controller. He would be probably a squadron leader rank and an ex-airman himself. And he was responsible for everything that went on. But we had a corporal on each watch. There was a corporal in charge of each watch. And, you know, just for sort of, I suppose, domestic reasons as much as anything else. Although they also supervised the table and made sure that, you know, the plots were tidy and disciplinary matters and things like that, and drawing up the watch and the days off and so on and so forth. But the controller was in overall charge, and he was assisted by someone who was called an Ops B officer, who was his sort of PA, and would, you know, help him convey orders and receive orders. And there was also someone in charge of a switchboard, which had direct access to groove and, you know, various headquarters, radar group headquarters, and the observer corps and things like that. And then also up on the dais to the left of him would be the army cooperation people in charge of anti-aircraft guns and searchlights, because of course, you know, it wouldn't have done to have the guns pooping off when the planes were in the vicinity, and searchlight people similarly. And so it was really quite a team. And then if there was anything particularly exciting going on, the CO would appear, and he was quite a character.
Who was he?
Wing Commander Woodall or Woodfall, I can't remember. Woodall, I think it was.
Why was he such a character?
Well, he was, I think he'd been in the Air Force quite a long time, and he wore a monocle, and he had, he was quite an amusing person. He was very friendly with Varda as well. And he's a pretty lively character. For instance, when we went into, digressing rather, we went into Sawston Hall. We lived in this, it was a sort of Tudor mansion really, and it was rumoured that, I think it was Queen Elizabeth had slept there, you know, amongst various places. And there were about seven of us in a large room there. And of course, the whole idea of having, you know, the operations complex moved off the station was quite new, and they were always getting visitors to the group. So the CO used to, and then when we moved in, the girls, we decided to put a shield on our door giving our names, and we put it in, quartered it off, and we had, I think, Queen Elizabeth in one point, list of names in another, the plotters' rod and plots on another quarter, and a pair of WAF blackouts on the final quarter. So you had it on a door, really started off as, so that we'd know, you know, that people would know who was in that room, you know, amongst our little group. But anyway, it sort of, I think the humour of it appealed to the CEO, and if he had any visitors, he just used to bring them up to show them our room, you know, which we got fed up with after a while, because, you know, if we were there and off duty, it was precious to us, and we'd get out of uniform and, you know, wash our hair and all that kind of thing, so we got to resent it. So one day, as a bit of a lark, we all decided that we would put on our dressing gowns and be, you know, thoroughly sort of, or as much laid back as it could be in those days, sprawled on our beds the next time he came, and it worked, because, you know, they opened the door and sort of, you know, looked, and we threw, and that was that. We didn't see any more visits from the CO, but he was nice. We liked him. He was quite a character. There seemed to be many more characters in those days, or eccentric people, than there are today.
Then, where did you go from Duxford?
Well, from Duxford, I think it was about Easter or April or May, I went to fight a command at Stanmore, which was an extremely interesting place, because instead of seeing just our bit of the country, we had a view of we knew what was going on in the whole of the British Isles and across the North Sea as far as Scandinavia and the Low Countries, right down through France, so that we could see the minute raids cross the coast of Europe, you know, we got a picture of them, and there are a lot more people there, and it was, the place itself was amazing, because it was way, way underground. We had to approach down several flights of stairs, and the whole complex was there, the communications and the filter room and the operations room and you know, restrooms, the whole lot. It was enormous. It's like an underground village, really.
What was the difference between the filter room and the operations room?
Well, the filter room, shall we say, they distilled all the soundings that came from radar into one plot. You know, roughly, it was, people have come to realise it was just as much luck as judgment in a way, or almost as much. You know, you got a lot of soundings through from all these radar stations which were around the coast, because they only worked out to sea in those days, of course, and they would all come in, and every sort of plot they got, every blip they got, would be plotted on the filter room table, and then someone, a supervisor, I think it's usually an officer, would create the actual track, the probable track from all these soundings. But we were never, you see, there again, this security business, we were never encouraged to go in. In fact, I never went into the filter room. It wasn't a question these days where you'd say, now come along and I'll show you round. You know?